Hey, sweetie.
I'll pull it to you.
Oh, no.
You know, that's what it is. It's basketball. It's not a soft sport.
I'm going to be a man, and if you don't stand for something, you'll fall for anything. This man just gave me a job. I'm not signing that shit.
There's a lot I got to say, but I ain't going to do it here because it's free to hear. I ain't going to curse.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the NBL Pocket Podcast. Thank you for joining me today. Body Knowledge and I are talking all things Marvelous, his book that was published in 2008. It's the NBL. It's the best book on the NBL through the prism of Brett Maher and South Australian basketball. If you're in Sydney, Melbourne, or Perth, you will not be left out just because this is a Brett Maher story. It's not just the Brett Maher story. It's a handbook on the league. And Body and I talk about why that is the case. As I was saying, it's the best handbook on the league. It's a must-read. If you're ever sideswiped by a cynical, well-actually NBL type on social media, just simply reply to them. You seem to be, or at least think you're an authority on the league. Have you read Marvelous? If their reply is no, then calmly, virtually, turn on your heels, bid them farewell. They more than likely don't know what they're talking about. Having a byline, blog, or podcast is not enough to impress anymore. You, the fan, with Marvelous in your back pocket, are just as informed as, if not more, than a lot of the people commenting on the league now. Why not get a copy? You can purchase your mint condition signed copy of Marvelous via the link in the description for $30. There, now that all the sales out of the way. If you're listening and haven't given the show a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, it'd be really swell if you took the time to do that. Thanks in advance. And also, on a side note, big thank you to Booktopia for coming on board as a quote-unquote sponsor. After selling copies of Marvelous and being an affiliate of Booktopia probably about 6 or 8 months ago, I really can't be too sure, this podcast has sold over 50 books and counting, and that's books on cookery have been bought via the link. A number of copies of The Jordan Rules have been bought, Bernard King's autobiography, and even Gaze, the Lindsay Gaze story by Grantley Bernard, which is coming out very shortly. Strangely, even through the affiliate link on Booktopia, someone's bought a copy of The Feminine Mystique and The Kama Sutra in one transaction. So you don't have to buy basketball books, and they are the furthest thing from basketball, although it does involve things going in hoops. Also, I will have another podcast coming out this week previewing the season. I've held off on that, as you can all probably imagine, because of the schedule. That's probably going to come out Thursday. May or may not have a guest for that. And hey, Andrew Canyon and I, who's often featured on the program, we've worked out how to co-stream and commentate NBL games on Twitch. So I have more information on that. And we're going to have a lot of fun. Maybe even some guests to come in and chat to us during the game and commentate the game who aren't part of the commentary team, which could be fun. Now, before we launch into our chat, my chat with Body Knowledge about Marvelous, I'm going to lay a few pages on you. You get these for free. Just in case there's a couple of people out there who are interested in buying but are still unsure. Now, I've chosen this section because I think it's highly relevant to what's happening and what has happened at the Sydney Cricket Ground at the cricket test, the racial comments that have been thrown out at players there. Now, I'm not saying that the situation I'm about to read from Marvelous and that are the same or will have the same outcome or the same circumstances, but they both involve what would be classed racism in Australian sport, and I thought this might give an interesting little insight into racism in the NBL and Australian crowds. This is from page 184 to 185 of Marvelous, and so it begins. There was no doubt Brett Maher most definitely had arrived as one of the NBL's premier Australian players, but his clashes with Shane Heal always were the most eagerly anticipated. Adelaide headed to Sydney looking to clinch a place in the NBL's top four, but Dunlap, the Adelaide 36ers coach at the time, decided to play Rick Brunson on Australia's point guard. It did not work out well. Not only did the Kings record a whopping 140-120 victory, only twice previously had the club conceded more points in a game, and both in Don Shipway's defenseless era, but Brunson was cited by the NBL for spitting on Heal. A volatile game from the outset. The incident occurred late in the first quarter. None of the referees saw it, and Sydney officials confirmed they would not take the issue any further. But the incidents caused such a ruckus, the NBL itself felt compelled to act. In the second quarter, Heal received a technical foul for trash-talking Brunson while Adelaide's import prepared to take free throws. and while referee Bill Mildenhall was signalling the technical, Brunson was hit with one of his own by referee Alan Gooden for trash-talking back at heel. Minutes later, Kings forward Justin Withers received a technical for complaining too long about a foul call. This match was no, quote-unquote, friendly. Later that week, NBL Tribunal Chairman Ken Marsden heard a league-backing sighting of unsportsmanlike conduct against Brunson for allegedly spitting at heel. Many felt City had not cited Brunson because it feared the backlash when it revealed Heal had allegedly provoked Brunson with a racially based taunt. But he had not. While that was discussed behind closed doors and hinted at without it being publicly confirmed, it was a completely erroneous suggestion. I knew it was never a racial slur, Brett Maher said of the Brunson Heal incident. It was actually all pretty much amusing at the time. I was right there when Rick spat his massive loogie on Shane. What set it off had nothing to do with racism. Shane had said to Rick, quote, My boy Simon Curl is f***ing your girl. And he was quite specific. Rick lost his mind because he was seeing a girl at the time. So he spat on Shane, and when the game was over, everyone was asking why he'd done it. Rick played the race card and said Shane had made a racial slur at him, which I knew wasn't true. Shane had some black Americans on his team, and one of them was right there when it all went down. There was no way he would have said anything like that. But we ended up having a meeting and talking it through, and I remember Mike Dunlap was very emotional about it. He was saying there was a racial slur made against one of our players, but it got blown out of all proportion because it wasn't what happened. Brunson was found guilty and fined $300, but he did not engender much support amongst his teammates. He received his support from the coaching staff. I think Rick and Mike had a pretty good relationship, Ma said. From the players' perspective, things that happen between players stay between players. But as time wore on, some of the players were finding out he was talking back to the coaching staff. Things that had been said amongst the guys. At the end of the season, a lot of the players found out that he had actually been going back and telling the coaches what was being said privately among the players. A little bit of an insight into that incident, Shane Heal, Rick Brunson, and that Adelaide 36ers team that was good without being great. Well, that's all you're going to get for free. But right now, let's launch into my chat with Body Nudge. You can hear all about the writing of this book, why he wrote it, the chapters, the major questions that the book poses, and just the general story of a really great Australian player in Brett Maher. Enjoy. My first question on this one. We're talking Marvelous, and it's available to any and all of you. The book is copyrighted 2018, 12 years ago. How long before that date did you start working on this thing, writing it? When was it first the seed from which you'd grow this actual book, Body?
Brett approached me and asked me, we had a lot to do with him throughout his career. I was there when it started and there when it finished. So we had built a relationship over that time, and he asked me if I'd be interested in writing his biography. And I said what I've said to many people who have asked me that question. Yes, I'd be happy to write your biography, provided you've got a publishing contract. Because, you know, doing a year's worth of work on something and then trying to peddle it to somebody is not, you know, that's just... possibility that doesn't get published, that's a waste of my time. So that's always my prerequisite. Yeah, I'm happy to do it if I'm interested in the character and if they've got a publishing contract. Well, he did. He had one. He said, yep, it's ready to go. East Street Publications are ready to do it if you would do me the honor of writing it. And I'm like, oh, geez, okay. Then there's no question. So what we did then, this was over the course of a year, I say 2007, maybe not quite that long, but we basically set up a Wednesday meeting every week where we would sit together and I would record his answers to my questions. And each week I would say, okay, like, this week we're going to talk about the 36ers championships.
Oh, you wouldn't go chronologically?
No. We just because I think that keeps it more interesting. And I didn't intend to write the book chronologically. Pretty much every biography or autobiography I've read starts with, you know, the parents of the character that you're reading about and where they were born and when they went to school, and it follows a particular pattern. And I don't find that especially interesting, because in a lot of the the books that I've read about people that interest me, the first couple of chapters is like, I don't really care where they went to, where they went fishing when they were 4 years old, or
I'm not in yet. I need the sweet hit. I want dessert first. You want to do the Napoleon and then work backwards.
Exactly. And when I read the Grantley Bernard's story about Andrew Gaze, the book about Andrew's his life story, I found that I knew most of it. So it wasn't anywhere near as interesting to me as the new book on Lindsay Gaze, which I didn't know as much about Lindsay as I thought I did. But with Andrew's story, what I found interesting straight away was the time he spent in Europe playing in Greece.
Greece.
And I didn't know anything about that. So when I sat down to write Brett's book, I thought, well, I'm not going to write it chronologically. I'm going to try and grab the reader straight away by writing about the one thing that probably nobody knows about, which was his time in Turkey.
Yeah, right. It's Turkish Delight. It's the first chapter.
Bingo. So I thought, you know, I'll get you in straight away by saying that assuming you've bought the book because you've got some idea who the character is, you know, so you've got some interest straight away, there's a period of his life that you won't know anything about. The likelihood is you won't know much about this. Yeah. So I'll take you there and then I'll weave it. And that's how I want to do it. So that's why when we sat down each week on the Wednesday for an hour or so, I would say to him, all right, next week I want to talk about the Olympics, or next week I want to talk about your junior career.
You'd give him time to think about it, yeah.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Would he ever notes, or would he just go off your questions, or how would they?
I don't recall him having notes, but he was always well prepared because he knew what we were going to talk about. So, I mean, as is the case with most people when you're writing a biography, they often confuse dates and you know, like, oh, was that year at? And that's for you as a biographer to go and research and get correct. Right. So there was that element of it. But generally speaking, he had all the stories prepared for whatever the topic was. So, you know, hiding Easter eggs when he was at the AIS from the other guys. And he already had those stories sort of ready for me when we sat down.
Of course. Right. Did he, so how many hours do you think went into this book? Like, if you had to totally give a guess at it, how many days did you spend doing those interviews?
Well, I would say however many chapters there are, I would say that would be each of those chapters would have been a session. And then probably we spent a bit longer on the story of his son, Hudson, because Tanya obviously played a role in that as well.
Right.
And so I didn't keep those tapes because they're really, really hard to listen to. Mm-hmm. For those who don't know what we're talking about.
You know, we'll talk about, we'll eliminate people later, yeah.
Yeah, and so that was difficult because listening back to that, basically he's just got three people crying.
Yeah, right.
And so that was hard going. And that was the chapter I left till last. Even though it doesn't come last in the book, it's elsewhere, but it is the chapter. And that was the other thing about writing it, not writing it chronologically. I could move chapters around or weave them to sort of tell a story, I hope, in a more interesting way. Mm-hmm. Because in actual fact, I didn't think there was sufficient substance just to Brett's story. So I kind of made the book more or less, Brett was the star of a story about his era. Yeah, and so therefore there's a lot more NBL information in it.
Oh, yeah.
A lot more information in this stuff about Andy.
That's what I say to people. I say it's not just a biography. This is a handbook on the league. You know, this goes back well before Brett. It obviously doesn't go after him, but it goes before him. It talks about people. He does suck you into other people's stories. I mean, Chris Blakemore consumes a bunch of this, and we'll talk about him later. But, you know, it takes on other people are the main character for a couple of chapters or at times for sure.
Yeah, so it was if you wanted to make a movie about it, you could, because it's a different thing. It's not
ensemble,
just about
that.
Yeah, exactly. And I found it a great pleasure to write it. I'm so glad that he had the faith in me and trusted me to do it. Obviously, I sat and did interviews with a number of other people, most notably probably obviously Tanya, his wife, but Scott Ninnis, his close friend, and others, his parents, like Les, his father.
Yeah, we'll talk about that,
And Jan, I mean, Jan worked in the canteen at the Advertiser. So I had an independent relationship with Jan.
Right.
And if I went down there and asked for a beef salad roll, mate, it would take three people to eat that. She was fantastic to me. And there was always the fact that she's very truthful. So, you know, I'd go down. There was one particular occasion, I don't know if this might be in the book, I think it is, where I went down for lunch and she said, oh, I don't know if Brett's going to be playing this week. I said, oh, well, what happened? She said, I think he rolled his ankle pretty badly at training today, and because they trained in the morning. So I thought, oh, all right, well, okay, thanks very much for that. So I've gone upstairs and I've rung the coach at the time and said, how you going? Had training go today? Oh, yeah, okay, no problem. I said, no problem. A little bird told me that Brett Maher rolled his ankle and might be in doubt for this week's game. And he's gone, no, that didn't happen. I'm like, oh, really? Now, who am I going to believe? Coach or his mother? So we went with the story. It was like, how did you know, where'd you get that from? I said, I'm not giving up my sources. God. Well, I am now, but this is a
sources,
long time removed.
Literally, you know, as well with the kid. So how many hours did you sink into this? It seems like every chapter was how many hours? If you had to totally take a stab in the dark at it.
Oh my God, I don't know. It took ages. It was a solid 6 months. Work,
writing and working on every day,
writing it, and getting it right. And plus, remember, I'm a journalist, or I was a journalist at that time, working in basketball. So I there were days you'd come home, you didn't feel like writing. That was the last thing, a busman's holiday of thing. It probably took a little longer than it needed to in the production, but only because I was really intent on getting it as right as I possibly could and making it as interesting as I possibly could, because there were a lot of, as you've said, ensemble sub-stories going around.
Oh, yeah.
I'll give you a quick example. I was writing about Les, Brett's father, serving in Vietnam. And at that time, my oldest daughter was still quite young. Mm-hmm. And she was sort of came up and was leaning over my shoulder and said, oh, Dad, what's Vietnam? And that's when it occurred to me, all right, well, there's going to be a whole generation that know nothing about the Vietnam War. So I'm just referencing it as something that I know about because I lived through it. And yet there's going to be readers now, kids that are Brett Maher fans, they're going to go, what's Vietnam? So now I've got to do a quick explanation of what the Vietnam War was. Just sum it up for those people who don't really understand why we were involved, you know, why Les would be over there, etc. So that's how the story fleshed out and became more than just Brett's story.
The book, of course, is marvelous. Did you have any other titles in mind? It's marvelous with an exclamation mark. And I have read places that say you should never have a title with a question mark at the end, never pose a question with a title. Maybe that's movies, not so much books, but did you have other titles? You went with marvelous. Wow.
I had used that a couple of times as a writer when he had big games, you know, and then there was a period where he and Darnell and me were the 36ers backcourt when they won a couple of championships and they were awesome. And I used to write Marmy, how
oh
I
me
you,
oh
how
my
I
yeah
that sort of stuff. And so Marvelous to me was the working title, but I thought, oh, we'll come up with something better by the time we get to the end. And we didn't. And no one, you know, when I suggested it, everyone liked it. So I thought, okay, well, we'll just.
And it runs up the spine vertically. It's a nice design cover. Did you have a hand in the cover or someone else did that?
No, I someone else did that. That was East Street Publications. They ran a couple of ideas past us. And you know, that was, I loved it and Brett loved it. And so it was.
It is neat. It is a nice little cover. And on the inside, in typical NBL fashion, it's got a smattering of logos, you know, Brumbies, advertiser, distinctive Holmes Cooper. You know, that's the true NBL fashion of the time.
That's how we guaranteed it got.
Exactly.
All these people were on board.
The book has a Dewey decimal number, 796.323092. What decides a Dewey decimal number, or am I out of my mind here?
You're not out of your mind, but you're certainly out of mind. I don't know.
I was like, I wonder how they, it's like the masculine and feminine with like a French language. Like, how do they decide what's masculine and feminine? They just do.
You ask the weirdest questions.
Here we go. I'll ask this one. When you were starting out, did you write a rough draft or skeleton of where you were going to put the chapters? You said how they're not in chronological order. What decided where you put it? Did you kind of have like, you know, all 20 in mind? I think it's 20 or 19.
Yep.
And sort of slide them in position. How did you know you were going to do not just that first chapter was going to be Turkish Delight, but thereafter?
I knew the first chapter was, I wanted it to be, as I said, something that no one knew about. So let's get them in. Here's something they don't know about. So that was pretty much decided instantly for me. And I knew that I would end it at where his career ends. Okay. So I had the beginning and the end, and then how I wove it just depended on how I felt at any given time. I just thought, oh, this will lead in nicely to that. Okay, I'll go there. This will go. So it was basically, it happened kind of more organically than planned. They just sort of flowed into each other. The only chapter I kept putting off was the one about Hudson. I admit it. I knew that was going to be the most difficult one to write, because there was a huge degree of sensitivity necessary, and also it's such a sad story. And I didn't, and yet he's such an uplifting little guy, or he was. So yeah. It was. I wanted it to be as positive as it could be. So I thought, well, that's just going to be difficult. I'll put that off. And then when I thought, okay, it's time. The rest of the book's done. And then I sort of started writing it and thought, okay, I can see where this would fit in. I can move this deeper into the story than at the end. You know, it was the last chapter I wrote, but I didn't want it to be the last chapter. No, I didn't want to end on that note. So, and then because I now had a rough idea where I was going to put it, I was able to sort of make the ending easy to sort of read into the next chapter. So yeah, it was a process, but it wasn't a planned process. As I said, all I had was I knew where I was going to start and I knew where I was going to finish. And then because I had all the information, I just did it the way I would as a journalist writing a story. You know, you go get the facts and then you put them in what you think is the most interesting order for the reader. So that's what I tried to do with the book.
Fair enough. Roger Ebert, the movie critic, says that movies are a vehicle of empathy. People tell a story and we empathize with that story and its characters to varying degrees. With that in mind, this is an odd question for you, so I'll give you plenty to think about, but what is sports, and in particular sports book, are they a vehicle of the same thing or are they a vehicle of something different?
I think it's a vehicle of exactly the same thing, because we're still talking about entertainment. We're still talking about being emotionally moved. You know, you can't go into a crowd at a sporting contest and think they're just sitting there on their hands, that is there for the pure pleasure of watching sportsmen or sportswomen compete. They're there because they've got an interest in it, a vested interest, a team they support, a team that they laugh with, they cry with, that they're there for the highs, there for the lows. So you've got that whole emotional connection to sport that you have with a movie, with movie characters, that you have with a play, that you have with ballet, whatever is your particular interest outside of your normal parameters of your work and life and relationships. That's what takes you through a range of emotions, and absolutely a sporting career or a sporting team, or they do. Everyone is aligned to something.
Yeah, right. In the foreword, Phil Smyth writes this about you. His fearless approach to finding the facts has not always won him favor, but facts often don't. My question is, are you or were you at that time nosy?
Well, I think you have to be a journalist. I think you have to be like one of those anteater things, don't you? Of course I was nosy in the areas that I cared about, but you know, I couldn't work in journalism today, because the way it was in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s and early 2000s is vastly different to what it is now. And
afford to be more intrusive?
Absolutely, because people didn't have access to their own ways of promoting themselves. It was through the media that you promoted yourself. So you know, we always had the attitude, they need us more than we need them. That was the prevailing attitude in the media. Whereas now, that certainly is not the case. Yeah,
totally.
So I don't know that I could operate the way I operated in today's world. No. Because my whole thing was try to get to the truth of a story. Yeah. And then write it, no matter where the pieces fell.
And when Smyth talks about winning, finding the facts, like what do you think he's referring to? Like what was your biggest sort of one where you ticked everyone off?
Oh, well, it was, you know, there's administrations particularly. Yeah. I would tick off administrations more than anybody else. Basketball Australia, the South Australian Basketball Association, the NBL, the WNBL. There's been some point at which I've pissed all of them off because I've written something that they would prefer not to have seen in print, because in some way it reflected their incompetence in a particular issue or just their amateurism, etc. My attitude right from day one was, I'm going to treat basketball like a major sport. I know that the newspaper doesn't think it's a major sport. It definitely is a minor sport. And I was happy for it to be considered the major minor sport.
Yep.
You know, and so I treated it with the respect that, say, people writing about major sports treated their sports. So therefore, if there was some dirty linen that needed to be washed in public, I did it. And it's sort of like I treated the sport as though, as it should be treated, as it is treated in the United States. Many of the things that the ideas I got were from the New York Post and Peter Vecsey, who was a writer there. And like he was my idol. And
he's ruthless. Would just,
absolutely. And always tell the truth, always know the backstory, always know the history. And that's what I did. And that's how I wrote. And there were people who loved that because now suddenly basketball was getting publicity every day and in a solid sort of real way. And they loved that, but then they hated it when it was like, oh, wait a minute, now you're exposing a couple of sores here. We had a Band-Aid over that. We should have left that alone. So I never tried to write anything that was detrimental to the sport. I just tried to treat it with the respect that I thought it deserved. And through that, I got my own credibility.
Here's something else. This is one that you've written here. Lesmar would contend it was some antipathy toward him, brackets, Ma, from Australian basketball's first family, the Gaze dynasty, that limited Ma's international opportunities. I've always felt Lindsay Gaze unduly influenced Barry Barnes and Brett Brown. Do you agree with this, with Les's assessment?
I agree that that's Les's assessment. And everyone everyone's entitled to have a view on everything, you know.
Yeah.
But just because it's in the book doesn't necessarily mean that I agree with it. I'm not sure that was the case, but I wouldn't rule some aspect of it out, whether there's a conversation that's happened with the Australian coaching staff and Lindsay as the silver fox, the doyen, and they've asked him and he has an opinion that's maybe negative. I don't know. I've never had that conversation with Lindsay. But South Australians generally think Lindsay hates us. So because that goes back to Werner Lind's non-selection for Olympic teams, etc., back in the 60s. So grab the Gaze book.
Well, this is what I was going to say. That was Grantley Bernard's got a book, Gaze, coming out. I wanted to say this. Dan Brown, author of The Da Vinci Code, has this line, and he talks about it on Masterclass. I've seen the ads for it. He goes, a writer should start with their villain because that will define the hero. And from reading Marvelous, I interpreted the villain, if there is one, to be Lindsay Gaze. Was that your intention? Is my interpretation at all founded?
No, honestly, no. Lindsay is not.
If I had to pluck out a villain in this thing, because it's not, there's not. But if I had to, it kind of would be, because that whole. But yeah, you used to talk.
No, I was going to say, well, Lindsay wasn't that directly involved at that time. I mean, if you want a villain, and again, I wouldn't paint Barry Barnes as a villain, but in his coaching staff, he had Alan Black and Brett Brown, and none of those were huge fans of Brett.
Right.
They were much...
Personally or professionally?
Professionally, you can't dislike Brett. Geez,
no, I mean, not possible.
That was the other thing, just segueing. That's the other thing I found, that there was not a soul.
Threw dirt on him.
who had a bad word to say. They had some stories about him, anecdotes where he didn't look good. But no one had anything bad to say because he's a genuinely good human being. Mm. And the fact that in his post-basketball life, he's a fireman. Yeah. And he goes up the ladder and he brings people out of burning buildings. That
and
should
he's probably
tell you
heavier, more stronger in his post-career than he is in his pre-career. He's massive now.
I had a conversation with him a while back. I said, you know, are you feeling fitter now than when you were playing? He said it was a different sort of fitness. It's not like diving on a loose ball when you're trying to carry someone out of a building sort of thing. So, just the sort of human being he is. So you cannot dislike him. Plus, he's witty and he's funny. He's a great guy to be around.
Yeah,
and his friendship group is huge. So, no, I would not say in any way, shape, or form that Barry Barnes, Alan Black, or Brett Brown had any kind of personal issues with Marzi. Not at all. But I think they didn't see him enough to rate him above or level to say a Shane Heal or Andrew Gaze was like Andrew Gaze, you know, he's the number one, so that no one was going to be rating alongside him. But where again, you know, I think just segueing, sorry, I'm going all over the place, but back at the 92 Barcelona Olympics, when we had Andrew Gaze and Leroy Loggins, you know, I didn't think they played together enough in that Barcelona Olympics team. I think they're sort of like Leroy was Andrew's sub sort of thing or vice versa. And that wasn't the way to get it right. But anyway, that's a different story.
Yeah.
Getting back to Marzi, I think that if you're looking for villains, well, you know, the big villain of the era for the Adelaide 36ers was Brian Goorjian.
Right.
You know, as coach of the Southeast Melbourne Magic and the Victoria Titans. And, you know, you can find villains, but they're not, it's sport. They're not real villains. They're not people you can really, you know, dislike. You can boo them. Like a pantomime.
And even in your book, do you think people would be booing to, oh, here's, you know, Lindsay's got a mention or Gordon's got a mention. From what you've written, do you think people would make that?
I hope not. I honestly, I'm going to tell you something now. I love all those guys. I love them. I love Lindsay. I love Brian. You know, I love all of those people because of what they brought to the sport and their personalities. And they were prepared to say, like Bruce Palmer, like some of the things he said in quotes were just gold, you know, it was magic. It was a magical era, a magical time to be involved. And so I have no angst with any of them. I genuinely love them and what they brought to the sport and what they allowed me to get away with and to write, to sort of enhance that whole, you know, black hat, white hat thing where people are coming into town and, you know, the crowd's revved up and you've revved them up and they played their role in that too.
Yeah,
absolutely. Right. In the things they've said to sort of help.
What can you tell us about Lindsay's highly charged confrontation? And I've got that in quotation marks with Werner Lynn. Give us the people the backstory to that.
I find it amazing in as much as, look, in 72, at the 1972 Olympics, there were 11 Victorians selected for the Australian team and one South Australian. And in 1976, there were 10 Victorians selected and two South Australians, and Lindsay was the coach of both of those teams. And there was a very strong feeling across Australia that basically he was just selecting Victorians because, you know, he's Victorian and they did have by far the best domestic competition. But when it came to putting all-star teams together, you know, to represent the state at national championships, well, you know, South Australia was consistently winning them and New South Wales won its share. So there were other players around. So come 76 and 10 Victorians are named in the team and some entrepreneurs in South Australia decided it would be a good idea to have an SA all-star team play against the 10 Victorian Olympians. So they invited them to do this in I think it was late 1975 because Ken Richardson was an American superstar of the era who was playing here for West Adelaide. So they named the team and Ken was in it, the South Australian team, and Ken was in it. And then the game was postponed till 1976 for various reasons, but South Australia was still, you know, technically able to use Ken, even though at that time he was playing for St Kilda in Victoria once again. In what is by far the best domestic competition in Australia, that was not even a question. You know, the VBA competition was on another level, right. And which is why Lindsay contends that it was wrong that when the NBL started, there were only two Victorian teams in it, because you know, and it was heavily weighted towards New South Wales teams and others, when Victoria was the dominant
D product
club. Yeah. So I mean, he's got a very good point there. Anyway, so 76 rolls around and the 10 Victorian Olympians come into town in South Australia. You know, people like Werner Lind, who was selected in 1964 when he was a teenager and went to the Tokyo Olympics. He won the final for South Australia in the national championship that year. They played Victoria. They were in trouble. He was a kid. Keith Miller, the coach, gambled on him and he got 17 points in the second half and South Australia won. And he was named in that Olympic team. And then he was named in the 68 Olympic team, which didn't quite get there. They got to Monterey and got knocked out in the qualifications.
Right.
The interesting thing is they still got to March. So that's an interesting thing to me. So you sort of go, well, were they Olympians? Did they make? Well, they didn't actually make the Olympics, but they were there. So that becomes a sort of a technical grey area, I think. So, but that team had a mix of Victorian, South Australians, and New South Welshmen, and it was coached by Lindsay's mentor, Ken Watson. And there were just issues within that group. There were ego issues and. Ken Cole, who was, I think, at that time, I think he was a Victorian at that particular point, and Werner Lind, who was our absolute superstar in South Australia and still, I think, the best player we've ever produced in this state. They got into a punch-up at training, and that was a reflection of I guess, the tensions within the team. But, you know, these days there's a punch-up at training here, there, and everywhere, and everyone just moves on. But at that time it was like, oh,
yeah,
oh my
right,
God.
Right. Gentleman of the game, yeah.
Up in the Australian team. Yeah, yeah. And so the belief was that Ken Cole and Werner Lind's folders were stamped never to be selected again. Really? And that was the belief. Whether that ever happened, you know, that's again up for discussion. But at that particular point, it was certainly felt that way. Coley got picked again in 1970 for the World Championship, but that was the end of him. Right. So he was coaching the South Australian team in 1976. Werner was a player on it, and they couldn't wait to get Victoria into Apollo Stadium, and in come the 10 Victorian Olympians, just ready to play a game. You know, Lindsay's completely oblivious to the extent of feeling in South Australia. That stadium was jam-packed. You could not have got a sardine in there. And Ken Cole had wisely brought in all the South Australian sporting icons of that era, Neil Curley, Graham Corns, from other sports, the cricket players. And they didn't even go into the change room. They went into the boardroom at Apollo Stadium where all these South Australian icons were standing there as Coley revved his team up. Here's our chance to show the world the injustice, you know, all that sort of stuff. Yeah. So they go out on the court and they win. They win. They beat the 10 Victorian Olympians.
Wow.
And then Werner gets up to accept the winner's check because there was a huge, huge financial incentive as well, $500 to the winner. Seriously. Anyway, he goes up to accept the winner's check and he takes this piece of paper out of his pocket. And then, you know, the crowd laughs because it ends up being three or four pages and everyone thinks, oh, this is a Werner joke. Well, Werner spends the next couple of minutes thanking the Olympic team for being, visiting South Australia for the first time in X amount of years. And he basically uses the game as a justification to show that there's been bias in selection and that it's been going on for years. And
he's just rambling about this.
It's not a ramble. It's a really
constructed.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And the crowd's gone from, Werner, cut it out. Oh, geez, Werner, what are you doing? You know,
he's won him over.
And then they've gone from, wait a minute. Why is so-and-so in the team? And then suddenly like it's gone from a few sort of wolf whistles and stops to hushed silence. Everyone's listening to every word. And when he finishes, the place erupts. Like he's basically said, this sucks and it should never happen again. And he's used his own, it's a personal platform that he's used, but he's basically expressed what a lot of people in Australia outside of Victoria were thinking. Okay. Now, Lindsay is asked to respond. And again, Lindsay just misjudges the mood of that venue. And at that moment, he should have said, no, Werner said his piece, we're happy. And they leave. But no, Lindsay gets up and tries to respond and says something along the lines, look, we didn't know that Werner was available for selection. Jeez, that was a big mistake. Terrible one to open up with, and the crowd's just gone bunter and they're just booing him and jeering him and you can't hear what he's saying. I'm sitting in the front row, right across from him, across the court from him. I can't hear what he's saying. He's basically getting booed out of the stadium and basically he just goes back to team and they just sort of slink off into the change room. And in that moment, honestly, I felt very sorry for him because I think you don't invite someone into your lounge room and then,
and then berate him or set him up. Yeah.
However, I totally understand where Werner was coming from. Now, years later, when I've written about that in my own book, which should be coming out this year, hopefully, And when I spoke to Lindsay about it, Lindsay just basically had no real interest in talking about it. He said, I don't really remember it. And at the time, I thought, you're being disingenuous. Of course you remember it.
Yeah, right.
Jeez, how would you forget a night like that? Mm. But in knowing him, a lot of those things just didn't matter. It's like, okay, we came over to play a game. It wasn't really the Olympic team because the two South Australians in it, Andy Blitzarves and Andy Campbell, were starters in the Olympic team. So you can't really call it the Olympic team.
Right.
Later in the year when they had the national championship, Victoria played South Australia in the final and Victoria won by 36 points. So, again, he doesn't gloat about that in the same way that he doesn't carry on about what happened at Apollo Stadium. So Lindsay's got a very move on, matter of fact kind of demeanor and
perspective,
reaction.
I suppose, is the way to put it.
Yeah. It's like, look, we went to play a game and they turned it into something that it wasn't. Well, you know, that's their issue. We move on. The only reference to it in his autobiography, and I call it an autobiography because he wrote a lot of it, even though Grantley Bernard brilliantly ghosted it. He just sort of says there was a period where I wasn't terribly popular in South Australia. And you know what? That's what Lindsay would think too. Yeah, there was a period where they did a lot.
Let's take it back to Brett Maher. Let's go back to Brett Maher here. Brett Maher talks about playing in the first chapter, Turkish Delight, talks about playing in Europe or in Turkey anyway, more specific.
Yep.
And at that time, he talked about how Europe would shoot late in the shot clock, 16, 18 seconds into the shot clock, no freedom to the game. Is that a fair assessment of European basketball then and now? What is your relationship to European basketball then and now? Do you watch it? Do you enjoy it?
Look, I actually enjoyed Australian basketball the most because it took those elements of American basketball, has skills and you know the ability to beat a guy off the dribble one-on-one, the American game, and then it looked at the European game, which was a passing game, get somebody open, run some screens, get your best shooters into the best spots, you know, a real team game. And we had the hybrid. Our game was the hybrid of that. I just enjoyed, like, there's no game I enjoyed more than, say, the 1970 Australian Club Championship Grand Final between St Kilda Saints and Melbourne Church. That was just a brilliant game of basketball. The way the ball was moved, the way individuals were set up, it was terrific. So European basketball now has, I think, the more I watch it, the more staid it becomes. There's, like, give the ball back to the guard and walk it up the floor. And there's that element to it. Really? I don't find that particularly interesting. And I don't find the one on, I can't sit there and watch James Harden, you know, the move on and do the travel and do the flop and do all that. I just can't be bothered with that. So again, the Australian game probably appeals to me more than the American game. But if it was a choice of order, I do like the fact that the European game involves a lot of passing, a lot of movement, and a lot of using and utilizing your players. More and more, we're trending toward the American game. You know, Steph Curry has changed the game. There's not been, you know, like we might talk about Michael Jordan being the greatest player, or Wilt Chamberlain, or whatever, whoever you want to throw into the conversation. But when we talk about people who change the game, there's Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, who changed the college game.
Dunking and there's Steph Curry. T-way,
yep. And Steph Curry, who's now changed the professional game.
He's changed the invisible lines on the court. You know, they changed the frame of the key way for it. Steph Curry has just increased the what you'd call quarter court, has extended by 10 feet, maybe more. Because he can shoot it from quarter court.
Yeah. And so what does the world do? It says, hey, let's all do that. We can all adopt that. I mean, you know, when I was a kid, you were always shooting the ball from center. Everyone has a couple of shots from center.
Yeah.
So, and you get one now and then, you go, oh, you know. So, hey, now let's start training. Let's start doing that. Let's incorporate that. So, having said that, I still like the Australian game. I still like the NBL game. I absolutely enjoy watching that the most. I got it. And I know that's not a popular view, but there you go.
Let's talk more about Maher's game. Do you think Derek Rucker still has nightmares about Brett Maher? And you know the finals to which I refer. Because that's one of the most sort of like one-sided, one guy playing, you know, averaging what, 28 points, 7.7 assists, high percentages, and his direct opponent doing almost the opposite.
And his direct opponent was or and is, sorry, an NBL MVP.
Yeah.
But Derek was getting towards the tail end of his career, and with Brett was at the peak of his career. And I don't think Derek had any more nightmares than Mike Kelly might have. And a number of other people who ran into him when he was feeling that way. You know, he was an awesome player at his peak, and doesn't probably, this is that whole Clyde Drexler thing. You know, if Clyde Drexler had not just played in Portland, you know, for the Trailblazers in his NBA career, but had been in New York or had been in Los Angeles, he would be viewed much, much better than what he is.
You think Brett's on it?
Yeah, if Brett was playing in Melbourne, or, you know, his international career would have been far more successful, because they were, and he would now be in that conversation about our greatest players of all time. He'd be in the conversation. He's not in the conversation.
No.
The conversation only extends to, you know, Andrew Gaze, Andrew Bogut, Luke Longley, David Anderson, you know, and now we start to peter out and we start throwing in names of people that are probably a little bit fraudulent.
Right. I'll let that hang for a bit. chapter two. This is what I want to talk about.
We're going every chapter. No, I wrote it 12 years ago. I'm not sure I can remember.
You remember this one. By the grace of God. We spoke about it a little bit before. You spoke to Les Marr about his time in Vietnam. And amazingly, you said that was the first time he'd really opened up about that time in his life. Is that true? What were those interviews with him about that subject like?
Well, it was a particular Wednesday, and I was talking to Brett, and I said, okay, now next Wednesday, I'm going to catch up. I'm going to go visit your mum and dad, talk to your dad about Vietnam, because, you know, Brett was conceived during that period, so it was pertinent. And Brett sort of said, oh, good luck with that. And I said, why? He said, oh, Dad's never spoken about Vietnam. And
which was very much the way of it in Australia and the United States and pretty much everywhere in between. Yeah.
Yep, absolutely. And so I sort of said, well, you know, I'll see what I can do, you know. And so I went around and Jan, who I love dearly, you know, brought me in with a cup of tea and all that sort of stuff. And we're sitting around the table. And I said, okay, now you realize I'm going to have to ask some questions about Vietnam. And I was looking at Les, and I said, who's a very, very laid back, gentle sort of soul. And Jan kind of, I saw a shooter look over at him like, oh, you know, and then a shooter look at me like, oh, we're heading into dangerous ground. I don't know what it was. I think it was time. He was ready to talk about it. And he spoke eloquently and really told me things. And it was beautiful.
Wife present, or did you go?
No, she knew all the stories, she knew everything, but the rest of the world hadn't. Their kids hadn't, and so Brett hadn't, Natalie hadn't, and so yeah, it was fascinating, absolutely fascinating, and so pertinent, you know, given the circumstances of Les having I think it was a weekend pass or a few days pass, and he instead of staying. In Vietnam, he came down to Sydney and Jan met him there. And I believe that was, I can't remember now, but I think that's where Brett was conceived. So it was a pretty important weekend. And the guy who replaced him while he was away was killed.
Didn't make it.
Yeah. During that weekend. So had Les been back there, and just look, and the stories they told, I found fascinating. Just stuff about, you know, if she wanted to send him a bottle of wine, if Jan wanted to send Les a bottle of wine, say, just to celebrate something, whatever, there weren't post packs. We didn't have post packs back then. So they would buy a loaf of bread and hollow it out and sort of squeeze the bottle into that and sort of.
So as a protection.
Yeah. Absolutely. It's just stuff of that nature, which I found fascinating. I thought, well, if I'm finding this interesting, I'm hoping the reader will too.
Yeah.
So
my question was, why did you give it a whole chapter? In fact, the second chapter of the book, no less. And that, I guess that's your answer.
Yeah. Because so again, now I've gone from, we understand he's in Turkey, he's achieved. And this is how it sort of began over here. In during a war, a war that again, probably a whole generation knows nothing about.
That's my next question. The war for you, if I'm not mistaken, this book, rightly or wrongly or for better or worse, does reveal your age. Or your birth year, 1956. Australia's involved in the Vietnam War, 62 to 73. Fall of Saigon, 75. That takes you from 6 years old to 19, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
Pretty much your entire...
Good math. She's good
thank
math.
You, thank you. Pretty much your whole, quote-unquote, wonder years, if you've seen that TV show.
No, I have. I love it.
What's your take on the war and how it perhaps how it impacted you journalistically? You know, because that was the height of journalism. I mean, you've got a government lying, you've got presidents going crazy. You know, it's a crazy time.
Yeah. And all the way with LBJ whenever he mm-hmm. visited Australia, and Harold Holt and all that. Yes, I lived through that, and it was a fascinating period. But I think now when you look back on history, you know, there was that theory that was huge at the time, the domino theory. We've got to stop the communists. It's a domino theory. If Vietnam falls, then the next one, Laos, will fall, and Cambodia will fall, and the world will be red, you know. And given that my parents and family had fled communist Hungary, there was that mood across Australia was that it was a genuine fear that the communists will be at our border and who knows what the future will hold. Whereas I don't think that's what it was about much at all now. I think when you look back on it, it was just about inequities and as is the case with most, so is, shall we say, civil wars, is that there's the rich getting rich and the poor getting poorer, and at some point when there's no middle, then the poor rise up, and I think really had we as a nation not gotten involved, it probably would have been a better decision. But that's talking about it in 2021, not at that time when we were very much beholden to the United States and we believed them as they were our big brother and whatever they were doing was right and righteous and we were going to be joining in wherever they did. The world has changed dramatically. And I think if this was the world now, I don't think we would get involved.
Mm. No, I don't think so either.
And it was huge. And just watching on the, you were basically, in the end, you were having your dinner watching the body bags being shipped onto the helicopters
Australia was 550 dead or something like that soldiers.
Yeah, but I mean, you just in the end you became immune to it, and think about that. You know, these young Australian boys are going over there. You know, I've always believed that if you want to have a war, your army should start at the age of 50 year old plus. You can go to war. You know, we're not going to ruin our 17, 18, 19-year-old futures. And I think people would think differently. Politicians would think differently if it's like, oh, we're going to go to war, but it's everybody in this room that's going to be taking up arms.
Right. Well, there's that famous Red Gum song, Only 19.
Yeah, yep. Yeah. So, growing up with it, I thought it was a very important part of the book. Which is why I addressed that early. I found the stories that Les told to be really good and that is so candid. Like I said, I think it just reached that point. He had just reached that point in his life where he was like 30 plus.
And I guess you asked as well.
Yeah.
very few people answer questions they're not asked. So
that's a very good point. I might be one of them.
I want to talk about Chris Blakemore. You write in your book, and the quote is, literally walked away from the game at 23. Blakemore's career was over, another victim of burnout. Tell people about Chris Blakemore and why you ended up writing that and why that came to be.
Well, he was a kid from Wyala with this magnificent Charles Barkley-ish physique, where he was, I think he was 6'4", really, maybe on a good day, if he's on his tippy toes, 6'5", and massive chest, just a wide body, and he played big. He played like a power forward. That's why I make the Charles Barkley type comparison. So he came to Adelaide, was brought in by West Adelaide, immediately was a bit of a star, got taken to the AIS, went through that program, came back and joined the 36ers and was in an Australian squad when Magic Johnson was touring Australia with his team, and they played the Australian team at what was then the Clipsal Powerhouse. And after the game, Magic spoke and singled him out as being really impressed with Chris Blackburn. Now, when Magic Johnson singles out, it's an Australian team. He didn't know that Chris was an Adelaide guy, so that the Adelaide fans there were even more thrilled about it. But he singled him out as a player with amazing potential. And this would be also a player that a lot of people would have said, oh, you're not big enough to play that position, or you're not skilled enough to play that position. Right. You know, he was one of those guys that was out of the box that was proving people wrong. And Mike Dunlap, who was the American coach at that time, coaching the 36ers, became a bit of a father figure to him. Now, before Dunlap ever accepted the role in Adelaide, six young guys, including Brett Maher, Brett Wheeler, Tim Brenton, a few, and Chris Blakemore, were invited to go over to the United States and train with his college team before he got here. So he had a fair idea of the young guys, which is ultimately why he didn't last in Adelaide, because he was more interested in the young guys than the experienced guys, and it was the experienced guys that were going to win him a championship at that particular point. But anyway, that's, again, a different story. But Dunlap became very close to Chris Blakemore, and then there was the infamous incident where Chris elbowed Martin Catalini during the playoffs in the semifinal and busted his face open. And Chris naturally got reported for that. And I think he was rubbed out. And at that time, I think he really needed Mike Dunlap's support publicly, and he didn't get it. And I think that really hurt him as a young man.
Really?
And he then, I think he spent some time in Canberra, and then
Newcastle, just those weird teams that are no more.
Yeah, he'd lost his way a little bit, and he'd lost his faith.
On court, off court?
On court, but then that kind of led to off court, because when you define yourself in a particular way, and I'm not sure that he was defining himself, but I would presume, and I would say this from a position of some knowledge, that if you've come, you've been plucked from Whyalla and you've sort of had this.
And sorry, Whyalla for people who Whyalla's.
Oh, sorry, it's a country town in South Australia where we build submarines.
Okay.
I think that just about sums it up. Anyway, you've been sort of plucked out of that, and then your career trajectory has gone through this sport. You have become a very public figure, well known and very popular, including on their overseas tours. Which
nice chapter. that everybody's referring to when they go to Chicago and two Chicago cheerleaders are basically fighting over Blakemore in the hallway as to who's going to, you know, take him out for milkshakes.
Yeah. So, what's that song about milkshakes? Anyway, I'm thinking very much that Chris defined himself as a basketball player. You know, that was his debt. You know, he wasn't, you know, a born again Christian or a reformed smoker or you know, anything else. You know, the way people define themselves when they limit those definitions of themselves to those sort of things. I think he was seeing himself as a basketball player. That's what he did. He got up in the morning and he'd hit the gym. He would be on the basketball court. He'd be working on his shot. Then he'd play. Like that was his life, essentially.
Right.
Now the people you trust within that life have let you down. I think you're now a little lost as to how you proceed. And so he needed to get out of Adelaide, he felt, and I think he went to the Canberra Cannons, as did Robert Rose. And then it was Brisbane Bullets. Brian Curlett was the coach at the time. I think he reached out to Chris and said, look, you know, come here, we'll give you a shot. And Chris was like keen to go. And initially it was looking pretty good. And then I think they were coming home from Toowoomba or somewhere like that, where they played a practice game, a preseason game leading into the year. And Chris just said, oh, look, you know, can we stop the bus? And they stopped the bus. He got off, he got his bag and just walked off.
Wow.
And
never, you know, returned.
Brian never returned to the game. But now I believe he's a social worker working with young people. And you know,
what
he's
motivated that decision to just get his bag and go?
I haven't had the conversation with him, but I'm just sort of guessing that sitting in that bus, he might have just thought, nah, this isn't for me anymore. I wanted to give it a shot, but, you know, nah.
I'll cut this out if I need to, but are we talking sort of like drugs, alcohol?
No, not at all. It's more or less, I think it's just, again, I haven't spoken to Chris for a while, but to me, putting the pieces together, it makes sense to me that he's sitting in that bus. Brian Curl has given him this other chance to play for the Bullets, return to basketball. And he's been away from it for a while. He's done the training. He's been doing, and they played a practice game, and they're in this bus. They're driving back toward Brisbane, and he's thinking, no, I'm over it. Yeah.
Wow. It doesn't matter. Walkabout situation.
Yeah, he's just like, can we stop the bus? And they're like, yeah. Everyone's thinking he's going to go for a leak or something, get his bag and walked off.
That's kind of cool.
And it is. Sort of,
it's dramatic. It's great.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a great story. I hope it's true. I mean, I trust Brian, but I haven't spoken with Chris in a long time. And then he sort of, whatever cloud he went into for a few years, I don't know. But right. He certainly emerged at the other end as a person who cares about human beings and who's dedicated his life to
good outcome.
To helping you. Yeah, yeah. So basketball wasn't for him anymore. So that's the Chris Blakemore story as I know it. But I
in miniature, it's covered in Marvelous, by the way, available now for purchase if you're listening. Booby, the Shylock chapter, the sort of the chocolates, essentially, as best I can tell. Brett Maher is at the AIS. He hides. He sort of takes people's chocolates, hides it, and eats them in secret. Tell the story quickly, but then also I want you to comment on like writing about something that's got a racial element, that they call them Booby, which is a Jewish thing. Like, was that at all sort of, did you have any, you didn't have any problems with putting that in the book?
Not at all. No, because it wasn't really a racist sort of thing. No. I mean, you got to think about the era that you're talking about and what the mores of the time, what was socially acceptable at the time, and which may not be now, which is, why a lot of people get found out now for things they did that weren't necessarily right. I'm talking your Rolf Harris's and your Bill Cosby's like you might have thought, well, that was okay for that. Well, no, actually it wasn't. Whereas in this instance, that's the way it was. People were making jokes. So what it was, I think from memory, it was Easter and he had been sent a number of Easter eggs by his family, which he'd stashed in his room. So he was sharing everybody else's eggs in the common room where they were watching TV. And then every now and then he would nick off back to his room and
pull out his private stash. This is a kid of what, 17, 18, maybe.
Oh, yeah, the boys. And, I think the other boys just got curious as to what was going on and he got sprung. And so, the term at the time, I think if you were Jewish, it meant you were sort of tight with your money or tight, that's been, I've heard that applied to Scottish people and all sorts of things in the subsequent, fallout. So, Booby became his nickname.
which is a Jewish term for like a kid in a family, the little Booby, Boobala, yeah.
Yeah. But, it's just fun.
What makes this... It's the whole thing really interesting is obviously Maher, M-A-H-E-R, is an Irish surname, and that would be derived from Omar, as in son of Maher, which is from Tipperary or Kilkenny county region. And you know what it means in Irish?
No, go and tell me.
Kindly or generous, the irony.
Well, yes.
I wish I could have told you that before you wrote the chat. I was like,
I wish I'd known. But as it turns out, it was just, he's a kid.
But this name Booby just sticks with him forever. Like whenever he's bumping into people who went to the AAS or whatever, they're calling him
Booby. Oh, yeah, people from that era. But that's what happens. People from that era just remember you with that name. It's just like Rocky Crosswhite was a superstar American player who played for Melbourne Church and for Australia, got naturalised and played for Australia at a couple of Olympics, I think. He's now gone on in his professional life to bigger and better things within the government, and he's going by his name Perry Crosswhite. But people who know him from that time see him and say, "Hey, Rocky!" They're not going, watch me pull a rabbit out of a hat. No, that's a Bullwinkle doing.
We spoke about Mars game
for old listeners.
we spoke a little bit about Mars game. This was the one quote about his game that I really like from you. Consistently, Maher had stolen the show with his competitiveness, flair, and ability to perform in the cauldron. Is it a split? Like, that great, his competitiveness, his flair, and ability to perform? Or was it more like, his ability in the cauldron, in the clutch, was sort of 60% of his on-court brilliance or persona, and his flair was a bit around, like, where, yeah, we talked about his game before, but in the context of that quote, what made him special more so?
What made him special is that he knew when to take over. Okay, like there were times that he'd be one of the players on the team and he'd be doing his thing and he'd be collating his points and the team would be successful. And then we would get to crunch time and then it was Ma time. And I think if you sat Brett down and said, did you do that consciously?
Yeah.
That'd be an interesting conversation to have, because I think he learnt that from Robert Rose. I think he said there were times when he was playing with Robert Rose where he wasn't his teammate. He was an on-court spectator just watching Rose's magic, which, you know, didn't help Robert much when he's looking to sort of give it to someone and there's four guys staring at him going, geez, you're good. But Robert knew when to take over a game. And, I mean, guys, Andrew Gaze, Leroy Loggins, players have that ability to recognize it. Okay, I've got to just step it up a little bit from what I've been doing. And he could always do that, but he learned that. And in the 94 grand final, when he was still only a couple of years into his NBL career, when North Melbourne Giants in game one got right away, I think they were 19 up in the second half of that game. And it was Robert Rose and Brett Maher, the superstar, the established superstar and the superstar in waiting, who brought the 36ers back from that brink to force the game into overtime. And, where they eventually lost it on Darryl McDonald's winning shot over Brett Maher. But that was I still think that was a coaching error. I think there was a place for a sub there and I might have got Phil Smythe back in to D-Mac, and I would have doubled D-Mac and made someone else beat you, because again, D-Mac was again in that category of player that I've just been mentioning, who knew when it was his time to make the statement, knew when it was time to give it to Paul Rees or to Paul Maley or whoever else, okay, now it's my turn, I'm going to win it here, and I would have doubled him and made someone else beat you, but that's, you know, gone.
Do you think that's the best characteristic of a great player? Like a truly great player would be, you'd rather have less points quarters one through three and have that talent. That's the most important thing in your mind when you're categorizing, you know, best players of all time in your opinion. No, is that not, sort not of necessarily. Criteria that's pretty high?
Okay.
No, not necessarily, because we had in Adelaide an import by the name of Rick Brunson, who used to just do bugger all for three quarters, and then the last quarter he'd score 16 points or something. It's like, you know, okay, time for me to do my thing. And I sort of used to think, mate, if you could have done that in the first three quarters, this game would be over and done with. You wouldn't have to pull something out in the last. So I don't necessarily think that that's a brilliant quality to save it for the end. I think the ability to win a game off your own hand or off your own, and by that I don't necessarily mean score at the winning basket, but just know what to do. Know that right now we need a stop. Right now I'm going to steal the ball, this is the rebound we've got to get. This is the assist I've got to make, just to be able to recognize what that play is. That's what sets a great player apart. Now, you can take a Larry Bird, for example, and you can find that examples of everything I've just said.
Highlights,
a winning shot or a winning steal or a winning pass.
Good point, actually. Yeah.
And Marzi had that. He had that. He that was just inherent in his game as his game developed.
Hmm. Do you think he was shafted for the Olympic team? We spoke about that before.
Yeah. Yes, I think he was underrated. And I think because he's a laconic, sort of easygoing guy, sometimes coaches have to make decisions on who we're going to play and who we're not going to play. We better play so-and-so because he'll get the shits up and he'll cause trouble within the team, et cetera. You know, so so-and-so gets some court time because he's a squeaky wheel. Well, Brett was never a squeaky wheel.
Yeah.
He was always, you know, he was the team guy. He was a soldier. So,
could you have called this book "Nice Guys Finish Last"?
No, because he didn't finish last. You know, he's a two-time Larry Sengstock medalist. He's a triple Olympian. He's a three-time NBL champion. He was runner-up for the MVP in 2000. He's All-Star 5. I mean, this is just stuff I'm rattling off the top of my head.
Yeah,
they named the court after him. You know, they retired his number. I don't think you can say "Nice Guys Finish Last," but you can say that aspect of his personality that he didn't cause problems maybe worked against him.
Isn't that bizarre?
A little bit.
Isn't that bizarre?
Yeah, yeah. But you know, I see that today. I think
more so today than ever. Like the more challenging a person, often the better the outcome for them.
Yeah. No question. And I don't necessarily think that's right, but that's just the way it is. And if he had it over, I don't think he'd be any different. I don't think he would suddenly start being, you know, obstreperous and carry on. That's just not in his makeup. He's that sort of guy that wants to be judged on his merit, and he wasn't.
Yeah, wow. Last topic or question. I think you know where I'm going with this. The Hunter Marr chapter entitled Hudson. Hearts of Angels. I wrote in the margins when I read this. I wrote, the detail was painful but not gratuitous, confronting and factual but honest and ultimately hopeful is what I put. What can you tell people about researching this chapter, interviewing the Mars, plural, for this chapter and the writing of it? It
was extremely difficult because it was an extremely sensitive area, but one that obviously had to be spoken about and had to be addressed. And so when I gave them warning next week, you know, we're going to talk about Hudson, and they were quite prepared. And then we sat down and then, you know, turned the tape recorder on and started asking questions. Now, I would say their degree of candor shocked me, and there was things I left out, which I just thought, that's too much. That's too much. But both of them were quite prepared. I mean, it was an extremely emotional session, as you can imagine, but they spoke with such love, such joy at the pleasures that Hudson shared with them in the brief period of time that he had on this earth, that there was a lot of hope and joy in him that he shared with them. And you know, everyone always wonders, why does that happen? Why is a child stillborn, or why is a child born with a hole in the heart, or with leukemia? And these are questions that are really, really difficult to answer. And I was fortunate that I bumped into a friend. I don't believe in coincidences, just quietly. I think things happen for a reason always. And I had bumped into a friend who put me onto a book called Conversations with God. I thought, this would be interesting. So I bought the book, and I did find it really fascinating. And there was a second book and a third book, so I bought them all. Anyway, in the third book, in these Conversations with God, allegedly, there is a reference to what you are supposed to learn, or what is the positive, if there is such a thing, of losing a child as a baby or at a young age, or, you know, what is the positive in that? Because you really can't see it. And it was reading that chapter that kind of loosened me up in terms of how I could write it. That was very important to me in being able to approach that topic with Brett and Tanya, and also in being able to write it in a sensitive way. It was very difficult, but they were, it was a bit like Les talking about Vietnam. They were quite ready to sort of say, and also to give credit to people that had helped them along the way. People like Brian Gorgian, who was sort of, you know, the enemy of the 36ers, but at that time he was up coaching the Kings, and he allowed Brett to train with the Kings while they had relocated to Sydney for Hudson to be getting attention for his illness, which eventually claimed him within a year. And just telling that story, even as I was telling it, I found it to be more positive than I had anticipated. I thought this was going to be difficult because it's such sad material and such, you know, such a emotional thing. But and as I said, when I listened back to the tapes, you know, there's a lot of blubbering going on from the three of us because, you know, it's deeply moving, and the fact that they spoke of it with such candor, and it was I wouldn't say it was a pleasure to experience all that, but it was a chat that I was in the end very proud of.
Yeah, as you should be. The quote was from Neil David Walsh. Is that the writer of that book?
That's it.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
And you kind of spoke about why you chose him. You just read that and enjoyed it. I do have the quote here. I've lost it there. I don't have it on hand.
You can always edit it in later.
I will. I'll read it at the start of it. That's exactly what I'll do.
Yeah.
But yeah,
just in case, I'll say, hey, well done. You're so thoroughly researched and always have it at your fingertips.
That is all I have for you, buddy. That's marvelous. Why should people buy the book?
Oh, that was the book. Why? I think because if you want to know something about the history of the game, you know, as I said when we began, that I sort of made Brett the star of a story about the era. So if you want to know about that particular time in the game and how basketball went from the tin sheds to the entertainment centers to what it is now, I mean, doesn't take you right up to now, but you know, you certainly see where it's going. If you want to have that backstory, it's all there woven around Brett's personal story. So I think it's
It holds up today. I say to people, it is a handbook on the league through the prism of Brett Maher.
That's an excellent way of putting it. And what I would say is I wrote basketball for 43 years professionally. It is the single thing I'm most proud of, that book.
There you go. And it can all be yours for what, 25, 30 quid. So that's it. That's
a long ad.
It's less than a dollar a year of this time. So, wow, that's it.
Oh, thank you very much for promoting it.
I think people should read it. If I didn't know you at all, I'd still promote it. I think it's a great little book. It's got a bit of everything. Like that Hudson chapter, that's if you are a parent and you've never played basketball and you don't care, you should still read that chapter, if not the whole thing. So that's what I think.
Thank you. Thank you kindly.